Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage podcast. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm playing Chet today. My name is Nick Butcher. I'm from the Android Design and Developer Relations team here in London.
And our guest is...
Hi, I'm Zach Cohen, and I'm one of the tech leads and managers on the Android team here in London.
Nice. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I think last year... Chet was in London and he recorded an episode without me and he had someone basically impersonate me. And so I'm returning the favor today. So Nick has graciously accepted the challenge.
So my understanding of the role, Chet's role in this podcast is he very authentically pretends not to understand about a subject in order to ask very kind of probing questions to reveal the topic to the listeners. Is that right?
That is right. Okay. Yes.
I'll see if I can do that.
All right. So, Zach, you've been working on a lot of different things. You've been at Google for quite a while. Prior to Android as well, you were doing what? Gears and...
Yeah. So prior to when I joined the mobile team here in London, we hadn't actually announced Android yet. So we were working on mobile products at Google pre-Android. So we worked on... I worked on Picasa Web, which had a Google Gears integration, and that was on Windows Mobile back in the day.
I've used the Google Gears plugin on Windows Mobile back in the day. Thank you. It was amazing.
We did Picasa Web for the early iPhone web version, and we'd actually supported Siri 60 and Pocket Internet Explorer for Picasa Web back in the day, yeah.
Nice.
So you were doing mobile before mobile was cool?
Yep.
Gotcha.
And so your most recent project was the Together Watch Face, is that correct?
Yeah, so the Together Watch Face for Android Wear is one of the projects that we've been working on recently, yeah.
So what is that?
So Together is a way of people feeling more connected with each other through their wearables. So when we started the project, we were interested in wearables as a way of people staying more connected with each other and feeling a bit more immediate presence with each other. So we started thinking about interesting ways that a wearable could be used to stay in communication or just to have some idea of presence of another person. And we thought an ideal way to do that was to create a watch face, which you could send emojis and stickers and photos and show the activity, the sort of recognition for just one other person. We wanted to stay really close tied, so just one person connected. And your watch faces, you can send information between each other.
So when you say activity recognition, that's the Android API, which tells you if you're running or walking or cycling or in a car and so on.
Yeah, so we had an opt-in feature for that where you have an avatar of the other person on the watch face. And you can see if they've been on the phone all day, or if they've been running around all day, or if they've been driving. Or
summarizing their day, basically, into an image.
Yeah, it's a nice way of feeling that if they want you to, that how busy they've been, or like if they've been running a lot today.
Right. So there's got to be a server component to that, right?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So... the team who work on this were mainly client engineers. We've been an Android team for a long time, so we don't have a huge amount of back-end knowledge. A few of us had worked on various other projects that had them, but we're mainly client engineers. So we wanted when we first started the project, we wanted a simple way of adding a back-end to it. So we actually started the project on Google App Engine using Cloud Endpoints as a simple way of bringing up the back-end for it.
And that's using the, there's some support in Studio for doing that, right?
I believe there was, yeah. There still is. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we still have it.
Listen to me, I'm giving the tools in rather than you jumping on it.
Yeah, I was trying not to be too blatant. So, okay. So the app then is running, there's a watch face that's running on the Android Wear watch.
Yes.
And that does not have a direct connection to the cloud. So that talks to the Android Wear app on the phone?
Yes. And then the Android Wear app on the phone talks to the App Engine instance.
Interesting. And is this is Cloud Endpoints? Does that have some sort of way of callback? Do you have to pull, or does it invoke you at the right time, or how does that work?
So Endpoints gave us a really nice way of specifying what our like domain objects were, which in our case were sort of status updates. Mm-hmm. And then it gives us you a client library for pushing those from the phone to the cloud, but then also gives you a Google Cloud Messaging callback. I couldn't remember the name. GCM callback for when you want to get the same objects back into your app as well. It's very convenient.
This is also ideal for what you were doing then.
Exactly, yeah. We wanted to be able to push messages, and then whenever, even when we weren't phone grounded, we wanted to be able to receive those messages as well. So that's how we do it.
And then how do you get those to the watch itself? Is that using the, is it Messages API?
Yeah, so the wearable support library provides what we call the data APIs, and that gives you some convenient methods, things like, so there are messages, which is like a one-shot message in either direction between nodes on your wearable network. Then we also, the way we built it is we use a thing called the data items, which are data items you can create on the phone or on the wearable, and then they're automatically synchronized between the two. So you receive a message on the phone, we create a data item for that, and it's automatically propagated to your wearable.
Is that the thing which they describe as eventually consistent, right? So you can not worry about if the watch is there or not there, you write it to this kind of like data store layer, and eventually you know it will get
passed.
Yeah,
exactly. So you write it into the data item, and then it will show up on the devices.
Yeah, so because I use both an Android Wear watch and I use a Bluetooth headset, and it seems like I can't really use both at the same time. At least that's my impression. So when I'm temporarily, you know, using the headphones, mm-hmm. it seems like my watch isn't connected anymore. The whole point then is that when I, is that true? No, I'm getting too.
No, it shouldn't be the case. You should be able to use both.
I use it every day
time.
When I bike, I use my watch to control my podcasts on my Bluetooth headphones.
Yeah.
All right. So I have discovered a bug in a very bad way. Assuming it was like a one-to-one Bluetooth connection. Clearly that's not the case. All right. So even better.
You can even have more than one watch if you really want to.
Okay.
Enough of this messy back-end communication stuff. I really like Pixels. And I know, Zach, from working with you a little bit over in the past few years, that you also care a lot about making beautiful interfaces. I noticed the Together Watch Face is very rich. I have not actually looked at the API for designing a watch face, but as I understand it, it doesn't use standard Android views and like a view hierarchy, right? It's more like a live wallpaper where you're given a surface to draw on.
Yeah,
is that right?
So the watch face on a wearable is implemented kind of in the background, but it is a live wallpaper in the system. And then the wearable support library gives you a wrapper around that gives you a convenient canvas to draw onto. So the engine, as it's called, calls back and asks you to draw your watch face on a canvas.
So are you using like pure canvas APIs, like draw text, draw lines, stuff like that? Or do you actually like create views yourself and then use the on draw method to draw to the canvas? Or
so we experimented with using views and then forcing them to measure and lay out and then draw. But actually we found, because of the way watch faces tend to be quite they're quite specific in how they want to be laid out. So if you're using an app that maybe wants to be laid out on lots of different size screens and different geometries, you want things that are more like constraints, and you want to sort of lay things out logically. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're designing a watch face, because it's quite small and you tend to have quite an opinionated view about what you want this to look like. Mm-hmm. Actually going down to the canvas layer is about right. You generally want to be looking at things like the width and height of the provided watch face area, and then we've generally worked in percentages, so you want things to go in the center, and mm-hmm. then you lay things out, say, at 25% from the center. Then mm-hmm. when you have slightly different sized watch faces, so we have, I think there's about 16 different watches, and they have slightly different screen sizes, so by using percentages, you can get them to look the same, but maybe slightly smaller or slightly larger, but the actual watch face itself looks the same.
So not just screen sizes, but screen shapes as well, right? You have round and square.
Yeah.
So is that challenging?
To start with, we thought it would be, but actually when you start thinking about how you want to draw a watch face, if you're thinking about a round watch face in analog mode and you've got the minute ticks around the outside of it, that's not something you'd express as a view. You want to draw that with canvas because you're doing trigonometry and things.
So it's more like writing a custom view, sorry.
Exactly, yeah.
I was more thinking of, you know, the information design, right? Where you decide, I'm going to have this top left and this bottom right, right? But in circular, well, those are clipped.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, how did you decide,
So we basically just started with a square version and a round version.
Okay. Two designs.
And then we sort of move things when they make sense more on the circular ones. Things tend to go more towards the center of the screen. Mm-hmm. And on the square ones, we tend to push things sometimes more to the corners, sometimes in the center. But generally, we did two different designs for the square and circular.
And do you have access to things like resource qualifiers? Like, can you like query, you know, if you wanted to go and set certain dimensions for round and certain dimensions for, you know, non-round displays, can you use the resources like framework to help you with that?
I'm not sure. We were using, there are helper functions to tell you in code whether the screen is, whether it's round or not round. And we also have things where you can watch for the, you get told the window insets for a given display as well. So if you want to, so you talked about different geometries. Some of the geometries, for instance, we have round screens that have a piece missing from the bottom where the screen's connected.
Like the Moto.
Like the Moto 360. By using the window insets, you can get a representation of the screen is round, but this part's missing. So rather than drawing a round screen that fits inside the inset, you can draw it as if the whole thing was there. So you can get a fully round sort of canvas to draw on, but without having to fit it inside the full system window.
And that's the same window insets API as you have on activities and so on,
exactly,
in normal,
yeah,
Android land, which I never get my head around. I can never understand.
But I do think that the resources, they added a round resource qualifier recently. It wasn't in the first release of Android Wear, but I think I remember in the tools we had to go and update our parser.
I wasn't actually sure what version it was added in, so I didn't want to.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew it was there.
It's there now.
I didn't want to leak the existence of a round and not round qualifier.
Speaking of versions and so on, I think one of the nice things about Android Wear is, what's the main SDK you can rely on? Is it 21?
20, isn't it?
20?
At least it was added in 20.
So actually, all the watches are on the latest, so you can actually, it's 22, and I think it could soon be 23 on the wearables themselves. For the phones, we obviously support further back, but for the code that runs on the wearable device, it's pretty much just the most recent version.
Is that because they're just better about updating those than in the phone market?
All the watches tend to be updated like as the new versions come out.
That's good.
There's no app compat type version needed for Wear generally.
Not at the moment, no.
That's fantastic. And channeling my inner Chet here. So talking about not using views and so on, how do animations work? Because obviously you probably want to have like animation-y type things, like, you know, hands ticking or sweeping or whatever it might be on a watch face. Do you still use some of the kind of value animator architecture, or do you have to kind of like roll your own stuff based on, you know, time stamps and so on, or what do you do?
Yeah, so Together, for instance, had a lot of animations for things like when a message arrives, and we have animations for when the watch face enters the ambient mode, which is the low power version, and when it exits the ambient mode. It's actually quite a rich display. So we use Object Animator quite liberally. And the way we tended to do it was make sort of semantic properties for everything we were trying to show. So say, as we mentioned, the minute hand ticks that come in from the outside, we'll create a float property that says how showing are they on the screen. And then we can just animate those properties. And because we're in we have a canvas-based draw call, we just basically always draw everything in a parametric fashion, just whatever the value of all of the properties are. I think the analog watch face has about 10 properties based on where the message is, where how long the second hand is, how filled the hands are. And then you can just use like animators playing groups of them together to get quite rich and quite well coordinated animations.
And do you have to invalidate and use like update listeners and so on, or does it call back into you? Do you remember? Well,
I think you do have to invalidate, yes. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure you have to invalidate.
Cool.
What about the different screen types? I know that Android Wear has support for, you know, some of these watches where you use like a lower power screen.
Oh, right. Yeah, I had the Sony one, which had the low bit depth or something like that.
Yeah, I have an LG R here. And this one, you know, when I touch it, of course, it goes into active mode with colors and everything. But if I, you know, turn it off, then it sort of goes into this passive mode, which is black and white in my case. Did you design specifically for that?
Yeah, so within the engine itself, you get, there are properties you can read that say if you're in a low bit depth ambient mode, or if you're in, if you're on a device that needs burn-in protection, for instance, that's one way you want to avoid rendering big blocks of color, and just you tend to go for outlines instead.
Yeah.
our main approach for this was we actually designed an ambient mode that we thought looked nice kind of on all of them and accounted for all of those properties. So our analog watch face, for instance, hollows out the hands and just has like a key line around the outside. Mm-hmm. And we do the same for the avatar image. We put like a key lined version in. So on some devices, we could have made those richer, but we thought it actually looked quite stylish in all of the situations. So
I guess it draws less attention, right? Because it's just not.
Exactly, yeah. So we designed one that we thought worked for all of them, and then we didn't actually have to worry about the different screen technologies.
And one of the animations that we, I think I remember seeing, is that when you send your paired watch a photo, doesn't it show in full color and then slowly kind of fades out? I'm really interested how you implemented that. I've done something similar, but I want to know how you did it.
Yeah, so we wanted. So one of the things you can do is send full screen images. So you can send photos or stickers, which take up the full screen.
Screen of the watch. Of so the like watch. 300 by 300.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. But you still want to be able to read the time off it. So what we wanted was something which could go into the background of the watch face, and it would stay. It slowly fades over about half an hour, I think, or an hour. So that when you first see it,
it's a long duration animation.
It's there fully, and then it kind of slowly fades away. So we wanted something to like a treatment for the photo, such that you could still read the time off it. Mm-hmm. So what we use for that is a color filter, and we have a color filter which approximates the color blending mode you see in drawing tools. So it keeps the luminosity channel of the image the same, and then it blends in some of a fixed color, which is actually the background of our watch face, so that as it fades out, it goes back down into...
Oh, a color matrix, color filter. So you're just playing with the matrix of the luminosities and so on.
Yeah, so what we actually did was the color filter has... There's this built-in, which gives you a YUV matrix. So if you take that, and then you set the U and V to be a constant value. So the Y is the luminosity. You keep that, you fix the U and V, which are the color. Mm-hmm. And then you change it back to RGB. What you have is something where the color channel is fixed, but the brightness channel is modulated by the input image.
Right, I hope everyone followed along with that. Yeah, good.
What about the contrast? Sometimes it's difficult to read text on top of a sharp image, so often you blur. But I guess here, if you want to see together image, would be kind of annoying if it was all blurry too. Did you blur like just under the text or leave it all sharper?
What we do is we reduce in that same color matrix while we're calculating it, we adjust the contrast as well. So we actually make the image have a bit less contrast so that the white hands or the white text stand out. We also gave the text and hands some background protection, so there's a slight shadow around the text just to raise it away from the photo a bit.
Color matrix, color filters. Pretty powerful when you get your head around what it can do.
Yeah, definitely. We've used it, actually, there's lots of small places that you might not notice, but we use it quite a lot in the wearable products. So things like the watch face picker as you're scrolling it, people with sharp eyes might notice that the images, as they fade in, they start out desaturated and actually fade in through, as well as fading up in brightness, they actually fade the colors in at the same rate.
Nice attention to detail. I think that's actually, there's something in the material design spec about image loading, right? Which talks about loading the saturation and the gamma at different rates, right?
I really like the idea of having, say, a flat color and the image sort of seems to raise out of it rather than it just appearing at a uniform rate.
Cool. And before the watch face, unless there was more you want to ask about that, Chet?
No, let's go.
You worked on the, was it Auto Awesome Movies? What was it called? What was the name of the Android app that you could do really good video editing? It sort of suggests this video to you.
Yeah, so Auto Awesome Movies was a project we worked on here in London as well. Yeah, so that was, it would auto summarize a collection of photos and videos. It would find the best bits.
But wasn't it like also a full-blown video editor? Like you could pull in like audio clips and try different styles and...
Yeah, it had different styles and you could adjust the order of the clips and move the in and out points and... Yeah, render it with different themes and music.
Yeah, it was really fun.
So that's made its way into Google Photos as we know it now, right? We'll still do the same thing, but this was a precursor version, right?
So when we launched, it was in G- Google Photos.
Ah, okay.
So actually the first version was in Google Photos, and it's now still in Google Photos.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. We were talking about earlier, that has some really nice little UI flourishes in it. I remember particularly you were choosing the different soundtrack to accompany your summarized video, right? And as you swipe through the different effects, you had this beautiful like ripple effect that would like kind of, before the material design ripples were a thing, right?
Yeah.
Where it would kind of like bubble out from that. Was mm-hmm. that your team that built that?
Yep, that was our team. I think some of the designers on there might have had a hand in some of the material effects as well. So there were all some of the circular reveals and color ripples and things that we had.
So you can take full credit for material design, basically.
Yeah, you could say that. side note, I don't take full credit for material design. So yeah, that was another interesting concept where we actually thought we were going to need to do... A lot of the effects in the movie were applied using GL shaders. So that's how we managed to do live preview of color effects without having to render it offline and then play it back. It's all done through a GL shader.
It seems like you've had to do a lot of clever coding in that app, right? Because typically video editing is very, I mean, even on a big tower computer,
yeah.
It's very CPU intensive.
Yeah, so this right? was... This was totally real-time on 1080p video with live color effects. And
yeah, so there's got to be
all client-side.
On the phone.
On the phone.
So I mean, what's the trick? Were you just basically operating on tiny thumbnail data on the device and then like doing background rendering later?
No, it was all real-time and live. So the trick there is you've got to use the GPU to its full advantage. There's no way you add... No way, that's a very strong statement. I don't think we could have done it on the CPU. So the advantage we had is that pretty much all Android phones have a pretty capable GPU in them, especially when you're doing things like applying things like pixel shaders to a video frame. So by basically offloading all of that onto the GPU, anything we could do in a shader was included in the effects.
Were you using RenderScript at all?
We didn't use RenderScript, no. Okay. The whole thing was pure GLSL.
Okay.
And so if I remember rightly, you could select a number of videos and photos, right, and throw it at this app, and it would, like, you know, put together a highlight reel for you.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of boggles my mind. Like, are you, like, processing multiple videos at once? Because I start to wonder about, like, how many videos can you decode at once? Kind of, it sounds like a tricky problem.
That was a tricky problem because different phones have different capabilities. Actually, most of them can do... One or two. Well, most of them can do one. Most of them can do two at once,
mm-hmm.
Which actually allows you to do things like a crossfade. So as one clip's playing, you know, you crossfade to another one. For some of the more high quality videos, we don't do the crossfade because not all of them can do two, say, 1080p decodes at once. So you've just got to be careful about making sure the next video's lined up, waiting to play as soon as you switch over.
It seems like a challenge that, you know, the high resolution camera. Phones probably don't have twice the CPU or GPU capability, right. So you're almost at a disadvantage when you're recording really high compared to a lower end device.
Yeah, you could definitely do more if the video is lower quality, which is a bit of a shame. But I think we managed to do a good trade off between having something which represented the product for both of them, basically.
Yeah,
but we did it mainly by having selective features, so. If you can't do a crossfade, do a jump cut, but make sure that the timeline plays the same or the music plays the same.
Right. Do you remember, were there any jank bugs during development, and how did you A, find those, and B, fix those?
So the video playback stuff is quite tricky, especially when you're doing quite a novel video player, as in you're doing things which... have different color filters, and because one of the other things is a lot of the media, the earlier media playback APIs were meant for playing long form video, whereas we were switching between, say, 10 video clips for short periods of time.
Right.
So a lot of that came down to profiling. We use SysTrace quite a lot with tags put in and emitting those, and then reading back trace logs and looking at that kind of thing. And similar with the UI itself was actually quite rich as well. So we used a lot of SysTrace in there to find those kinds of bugs.
Yeah, it seems like SysTrace is one of those things that if you're going to do a really resource-intensive app, it pays off to actually learn it, even though it's
The kind of thing that might seem a bit daunting to start with, but once you've got into it, you know you won't go back.
But it's also improved a lot lately. I remember earlier versions of SysTrace, they were kind of like you had to know all the keyboard shortcuts in order to like navigate it, and they're all like the old game shortcuts, right? There was W, S, A, and D, right?
I remember when there was only ones and zeros. That's all you got.
But yeah, in recent days, if you haven't looked at SysTrace in a while, it's actually gotten pretty easy to use, but it also will say, oh, here's where I think the bug is, and also here's where I think you should do. So, for example, it'll tell you if you're, you know, not using a recycled view when you could be, and so on. Like, it actually gives you advice, so it kind of does your job for you, which is, like, my favorite kind of tool.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out again if you tried it earlier and were intimidated. You might still be intimidated today, but, you know, less likely.
And we found adding our own sections, so the trace begin section, end section, so adding our own.
That's in your code itself, right? You can actually use is it os.debug kind of .trace?
Yeah, I think it's trace begin section, then you can give it a name, and then you pair them with end sections, then inside the SysTrace you can see like hierarchical lists of this area is the bit where we try to draw a frame, and this is the bit of that where we decoded it, and then this is the bit where we try to draw it.
I see. So it makes it much easier to like read the trace later on when you know you've like marked it up. It's a bit like in can't you do the same with Hierarchy Viewer? You can actually annotate your properties. So say you're writing a custom view, right? You can mark up certain properties as saying, you know, this is a property and this is its current value, and Hierarchy Viewer can then see that. I think it's via an annotation, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're debugging your custom view, it's a similar kind of deal. It gives you more information to understand what's going on.
We've also found that spending, say, half an hour up front putting trace blocks around as much of the code as you can, even if you're not sure if that's the area, you can normally then read one trace and know exactly which part it is, rather than adding a tag section, seeing if that was it, adding another tag section. I normally just
go all in.
Yeah, you go all in on one go, and then normally that pays off in one run, you'll find the problem.
Nice. Yep.
All right, and before Auto Awesome Movies?
So before Auto Awesome Movies, I worked on voice search for Android.
Voice search. Is that the microphone on the launcher screen?
Yeah, so this was before the whole Google app became sort of joined together and we had all the search in one place, there was actually a voice search application which was started from that microphone on the home screen.
And were you doing similarly front-endy client stuff there? Or?
Yeah, so we were working on the app which was responsible for recording the audio and showing the interactive UI, delivering that to the back end, and then acting on. So we added voice actions, things like sending emails and text messages. So we had to work on the how did we take the server response and turn that into something that Android could understand, especially given that we wanted to support, say, any SMS app that was installed. So it's not just sending it through the built-in one. It was open to any of the other apps.
One of the things I really like about the voice search app is when you're speaking, it kind of gives you some indication that it's heard you, right? So you see these kind of words streaming out, but it's still listening for further context. Is that right? So it might actually go back and rewrite those. So it doesn't actually show you the words, because I imagine that would be quite, you know, disconcerting. If it gets a word wrong, you're kind of going to trip up yourself and stop speaking. Whereas if, you know, you just hadn't seen anything, just seen a shapeless form, which is what it does, right? Then you do actually carry on, and it actually gives it more chance.
I think it does both, because certainly when you start talking, there's a little, you know, dots or whatever showing that I've got some things I think are words here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I swear I've seen it actually get it wrong and then it fixes it.
Yeah. Yeah.
As in, it did a local thing first and then it went to the server and where it has probably a bigger data set or whatever, and it does a better job.
Is that what's going on?
So I think now we actually don't show the dots anymore, because I think it's actually got fast enough now that we just, and fast enough and accurate enough that we just show the transcription, and it's actually...
It's kind of remarkable how good this has gotten.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember back in the day, you know, where you would learn what were the voice actions you could talk to Android. You know, like set alarm was one of my favorite things, right? But there was a fixed set, or mostly fixed set of things you could say. And now, with the machine intelligence behind not just the recognition, but also the things you can ask, It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Especially when you pair it with Android Wear, where we started on. I find myself using the voice stuff with my watch a lot more, especially things, because all I have to do is raise my wrist, right? So I use it to set reminders and alarms the most.
Well, the point is you don't have a choice there.
Yeah.
So you're kind of forced to do it because there is no keyboard. And then you realize this is really, really good. And then it's gotten me using my phone for it, for voice input more than I used to, just because, wow, it's gotten really good now.
Yeah.
So I will never go in and set an alarm the hard way. You know, really, I'll just say it, and it just gets it right every time.
Mm-hmm. And then you end up with 55 different alarms in the list when you go in.
Yes,
and I had to clean them out because it drives my OCD crazy.
Yeah.
So that was Google Search. Was there anything before that?
So actually, before that, I worked on Google Goggles as well.
Goggles as in the image recognition.
Yeah, that was something we worked on. That genuinely came out of a sort of 20% effort between engineers, between here in London, in New York, and Mountain View and Santa Monica as well, actually. That was a big collaboration between a bunch of people, and an exciting one that went from being we've got this technology and it actually works to being something that people got behind and launched as a real product. That was quite an exciting time. Because we'd started doing UIs on Android that weren't just sort of, we had to do something quite new because we were doing an image recognition product, so there wasn't really...
There's no pattern for that.
Exactly,
I remember that UI, right? You'd see the image and you'd have this kind of blue light color block sweeping across it and it would pick out edge detection.
Yeah, that was...
I remember looking at that thinking, that's cool.
I think that got me the bug for... for doing sort of UI. So that actually did run a local edge detector, and then the progress bar would make it creep along the edges. We did have some bug reports, though, that if it was too fast, people would say it didn't analyze the whole image because the progress bar didn't sweep across across the whole image. So it was quite an eye-opener that sometimes you might need a bit of theater to convince people that, like, you know, even though you've got the response, you might need to sweep all the way to the end before
It's kind of those, it's just like with cameras making the clicky sounds, right? We kind of expect, and it's weird when it doesn't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think image recognition now probably doesn't sweep in that way, right? That's just a pure lie, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if you look at the way
it was
the
progress bar that looked nice.
Yeah, yeah, because now it's going to be like the convolution nets. Exactly, yeah. It's going to be layers instead.
Yeah, I'd love to see what UI you could build by taking some of those features. We were using edge detection features. If you could build a UI that used some of those.
We've seen all those weird art things where you take the models and you turn it back into images, right?
Exactly.
It'd be interesting to see sort of like this plus some
what
of the...
What does a progress bar designed by Deep Dream look like?
That's terrifying.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see...
Eyes everywhere.
I'm assuming when it runs this through the model, it's probably going to be matching several different things, and it'd be kind of fun to see sort of what the alternatives were that it thought.
Yeah.
Like, it could be a dog, it could be a cat, you know, it could be...
Sure.
Yeah.
So that was a precursor of something that came out recently. Didn't we just launch a web vision API? I don't know. It's probably beyond your thing.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I looked at
it. You were like ahead of the time on mobile, ahead of the time on image recognition. So,
yeah, I wish we could ask him what he's doing now and tell you about it.
We're still on Wear. We're doing exciting things. I'm excited about them.
I'm excited to see them when they launch.
I'm excited to use it. I haven't tried developing for Wear, and I really should.
Yeah, it's, I think, something that surprises people initially is that it is Android. So if you know, so the watch faces are a special case in that they use this Canvas and Engine API, but if you want to write an app that runs on Wear, it's an APK, you use views, it has activities, it's exactly the same.
But you install it on the phone. And then it gets pushed over to the Wear from there?
So your Wear APK is inside your main APK, and then it gets synced across automatically.
That's for releasing through your store, but when you're developing, right, you can just push the APK straight to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I remember someone asked me, do shared element transitions work on phone, on watches? And I was like, I don't know, let's find out. So I literally just had this app which already had shared element transitions and plugged in my phone and install it, and it just worked.
Yeah.
I was like,
so you can plug your watch straight into your computer and just run, just use Studio and deploy straight to the wearable as well.
Nice. The problem is that the watches I've had haven't had like a USB cable port anywhere, so I haven't really been sure. I'm sure there's some sort of deployment over Bluetooth or Wi-Fi?
So you can use Bluetooth, but say the G-Watch R that you're wearing, the cradle that it comes with for charging, that also has the USB plug on that works for data too.
I see. So I just put the watch back in the cradle, and
plug that
it
into
in.
Your computer, and you're ready to start developing.
Or the Sony watch I think I had had a micro USB port on the back of it, right? So that was super easy because you got 100 of those cables, until you switched to CN hanging around.
What's your favorite app on your watch?
So I actually think a lot of the utility is built into the things I use the most, things like the notifications and the agenda and the watch faces. Mm-hmm. There are some interesting ideas that come out of things that are just wearable. So I've got, I'm a percussionist, I like playing music, so I have a metronome app that runs on the watch and it vibrates discreetly. Giving you the time.
This is that you drum with one hand, the other one. You're trying to feel, you know, the beat.
I think it's an interesting area where, it wouldn't be as necessarily obvious to do that on your phone. Whereas because it's actually strapped to your wrist, it's a interesting area. And I think we're starting to get into a time now where people are really looking at what makes wearable apps different to phone apps. And I think the fact that it's always on, and we have an API now where your app can stay in the foreground even when the watch goes into the low power mode. You can provide a low power mode version of your app. So interesting things like Keep has one of these, for instance. So if you've got a shopping list on your wrist, the watch can go to sleep and you can still see the items on your shopping list.
I've used that with maps as well, right? So if you're navigating walking directions or something, your watch can go to sleep, but you can still glance at it and see the name of the street where your next turning is. And stuff.
Yeah. And I think there's some really kind of interesting and new things coming out of this idea that the screen's always there and it's always connected to you.
Have you used that API? Like, do you know, is there a callback saying, I'm going to sleep now, do you want to do anything?
Yeah, sure. You actually just get callbacks like, I'm entering, and we call it ambient mode. So I'm entering ambient mode.
Like you described with the watch face scenario earlier, it's the same for...
Yeah, you can just say, you just draw your background black, you draw your foreground elements in white, and now you draw nicely on ambient mode.
Is there some guidance on ambient mode, what you should do? Because I've seen some of the watch faces go completely black and white, and some of them use some colour still. So I assume it's up to the app themselves or watch face.
Yeah, it's
themselves.
Up to the app themselves, and then the app can decide what to draw, then the watch hardware itself decides how much of that to draw. So if you're going to be safe, you keep to black and white, because all of them support black and white. Mm-hmm. But things that have got things like the Sony smartwatch have... shades of grey, for instance, but we've tended just to stick to black and white. It's easier to support, but it's also the most readable. You really want something which is not, which you can glance at from a distance and isn't going to...
Well, especially in the daylight.
Exactly, and if you're not going to distract you when it's in ambient, it's nice to have something which is quite plain and simple.
One thing I would like to see is that I know that if I wear my watch at night, it's a little bit too bright, so I often go into theater mode just because I don't want to light up the room with my watch. It would be nice if, you know, what happens on the phone is that it sort of senses the surroundings and it dims. I don't know. I guess my watch doesn't do that. Or is it an app problem? Or
Some of the watches do. Watches have ambient light sensors. Not all of them. So some can do that. And there's some nice ones like the smartwatch and the, like this one, the Tag Connected, that have a transflective screen, which is... doesn't emit as much light and works nicely in sunshine. So they're nice outside. It comes at the cost of having a slightly less colour, but so you can pick depending on which one's important to you.
I need not proximity detection, but jacket detection. I find sometimes when I cycle home, my jacket's over the wrist, and if it gets wet, if it's raining, which it sometimes does in London, it'll detect it as a touch, and it will like pause my podcast or something. Yeah. And I'm like, no.
I think these are things that like new problems, so there'll be new solutions.
Never
for these
happy.
Things.
Yeah, I think that I have the original 360, and for that one, the battery life wasn't good enough, so I was always in like the where you turn the screen off. And I think now that I have a watch that is on all the time, it just makes it so much more useful.
Yeah,
so I think that really is.
We added it so that if you have, we call it all day battery life, but how long is all day? But if you have if you know you're going to be out for longer, you can turn the screen off. There's an option in the settings for the 360 things. The 360 could get all day, but generally it would turn off when it wasn't looking. But most of all of our newer watches tend to have You can keep the screen.
Yeah, I mean, this one's over a year old, I think, and still, it's going a couple of days for me.
Yeah.
The Sony one, in particular, I'd get 2, maybe 3 days out of it, unless I went running, then the GPS would suck down a lot of power.
Yeah.
That's GPS anywhere, I think.
Yeah, I don't blame it. But that was the best thing about it, in my opinion, was like going for a run wearing a watch and listening to play music and using GPS to track yourself without a phone was kind of cool.
That was actually another project that our team here in London did was play music on the watch, where you can sync music over from your phone to your watch. Then you can leave your watch you can leave your phone at home, and you can connect your Bluetooth headphones directly to your watch, and then you can go out running. You get your tracks
that was amazing.
Tracked, and the music playback all from your wrist.
I'm more of a podcast listener when I run.
Yeah, Pocket Cast, so please
only,
add that.
Yeah, or if only Play Music would ever add podcasts, you know, that would be
one
awesome.
One or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I like Pocket Cast, but I don't think they run only on it, so I actually use it for my phone. And then, so I carry a phone.
I think Pocket Cast have an app now.
Do they?
They have an app on the wrist, but it
doesn't sync
music over. I keep on asking the developers to add it.
That's cool. All right, any final parting thoughts? Insights, wisdom from an elder?
I think you've drained my reservoirs of insights.
Wow, I think this is interesting.
Well, yeah, thanks very much. It's good to have a fellow pixel pusher on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Who kind of cares about all these little details. They matter, people. They matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.